Hey guys, real quick before we get started, we are doing a free giveaway for listeners between now and May 31st. Cash prizes, free swag, yacht meetup tickets, San Diego Padre tickets, and more. All you got to do to qualify is go to Spotify or Apple Podcasts and drop a 5-star review. Send a screenshot to giveaway@summerscapital.com and we'll be selecting lucky winners May 31st. As always, I appreciate the support. Now let's jump into the show.
I love multifamily. It's harder now to find the deal. But I was telling you before, like, I feel like people are kind of phasing out a little bit. Like, if you were new and you started a year ago and you underwrote 40 deals, which happens a lot, right? No deals work. A lot of people are like, screw that, I'm moving on. And so we can get into this, but like, I just feel like people aren't super honest about multifamily.
Welcome to the Rich Summers Report, where we talk real estate, business, and wealth building, all while keeping it real. No fluff, no BS. I hope that you enjoy the show.
All right, guys, welcome to another episode of The Report. Today, I got someone who I've actually recorded two podcasts with in the past. We go back a few years now. He was a guest on The Real Estate Takeoff, my old podcast, and I was a guest on his podcast. I believe that was the first time we met. And last time we connected was at a meetup, our Beers and Deals meetup a couple of years ago here in San Diego. So good to have you back on. He's got 1,000 units as a GP in the multifamily side. I got my man, Eric Nelson. Eric, welcome to the show.
Rich, dude. My honor to be here. Thanks for having me. Yeah, I'd love to fly into San Diego. Love the city. Love what you're doing. So my honor to be here. Thanks for having me.
Appreciate you, man. It's not a bad city to fly into and do a little visit. You got a little family out here, right?
Yeah, so my wife's parents are here. They're amazing. Super fun to hang out with. They live out in Poway.
Okay.
Great views. Like when I come to Trent Town, they treat me like a king. Like we just barbecue and in the yard. And so I live in Colorado. So the weather's like so perfect here right now. Like,
these are the in-laws.
In-laws, yeah.
Does your wife come out with you?
She didn't now. She didn't this time. We got kids.
She just sends you out. Hey, go hang out with my parents.
See ya.
Yeah. Really? Wow. Okay.
Which they're awesome, man. They're so fun to hang out with. So yeah, so she's on with the kids right now. And I was like, I'm just going to cruise out for a day, basically spend two nights here and then head back home.
Okay. So two nights here. When do you go home?
Thursday. Tomorrow.
Thursday. Yeah, okay. Yeah. I love it, dude. Well, welcome. And you just hit us with some sunshine, dude. It's been cold. It's been wet here in San Diego the past 4 months. We had a record rainfall earlier in January.
I was watching all these floods. It was insane.
Dude, even on Monday, it was freezing. And today's Wednesday as we record this. And dude, it's nice now. We got some sunshine. It feels like San Diego finally. So hopefully this trend continues.
I nailed it.
Yeah. You did not bring the Colorado weather.
No. And dude, spring in Colorado is so funny. I was talking to Alex and we were like walking up. I was like, man, this time of year in Colorado is super hit or miss. I mean, you're still skiing, but it's slushy. Cold, hot, whatever, you know. But yeah, today is perfect in San Diego.
Yeah, I love that, dude. So what the hell you been up to, man? I haven't seen you in 2 years. I know you're in the multifamily space. What have you been up to since I saw you last, man?
I mean, let's be honest. Multifamily is hard right now. So like the best way to say it is head down. Like I'm coaching people, teaching people how to do it. That's a huge part of what I do. I mean, I've like found this passion. But we're basically like, you know what? We're not compromising. We're buying the deals that work and we're going to underwrite a lot of deals. So we're just like, all right. This is the time that we're like hitting all kinds of underwriting to know that we're going to get 1 out of 300. Like that's kind of probably how it's going. So we're just in what I'll call like a little bit of a grind in the sense that I love multifamily. It's harder now to find the deal. But I was telling you before, like I feel like people are kind of phasing out a little bit. Like if you were new and you started a year ago and you underwrote 40 deals, which happens a lot, right? No deals work. A lot of people are like, screw that, I'm moving on. And so we can get into this, but like, I just feel like people aren't super honest about multifamily. So to answer the question, dude, we've just been kind of grinding, like closing deals. Our goal is to close 4 this year, which is not a monster goal, right? But that would be really cool to just kind of keep this ship going. And the goal would be like ramp up as rates come down. We'll see how that goes, right? But for now, just kind of grinding.
When you say a lot of folks are not honest with multifamily, what do you mean by that?
Yeah, so it's like, I'm going to get kind of fired up, but like you go to like a... I'm just going to call them out, like Michael Blanc event, right? They have this like, quit your job, yay, multifamily syndication, you make all this money. And what doesn't ever get talked about is like, dude, how do you make money in syndication? You make money on the exit. Mm-hmm. I mean, your real money, right? There's going to be an acquisition fee. There'll be some cash flow on the way. But with a pref, you know, the investors are getting paid first.
Yep.
So like a lot of times you're not hitting your pref till like 2, 3, 4 years maybe. So the cash flow is essentially zero for the GPs. And so people are living on acquisition fees and that doesn't get talked about, right? So what I say is like multifamily is a build wealth slow game, get rich slow game. So if someone's like, hey, can I quit my job next year? I'm like, probably not, man. Like this is a side gig and it's a good one, but you're building wealth, you're not building cash flow in multifamily. So a lot of times what I'll tell people is like, do two different things, right? Like maybe hotel, maybe Airbnb, some other thing that can gain some cash flow or keep your job. Like you got a good job, you're in sales. We got some friends that did that, right? They're in sales and they just cruise. But the lie is you cruise to these events and they're like, sign up for my $30,000 coaching program. You can quit your job and get rich. The reality is, yeah, you'll build some wealth, but you're not going to quit your job and replace that income anytime soon, in my opinion.
Yeah. I'm glad that you brought that up because, you know, when I got in this game, it was in multifamily. And I think a lot of those techniques that are taught or are pushed, they did work in 2015, 2017, 2019. But since the rate environment has gone up, and I think we've seen the most, I mean, when I was underwriting deals last in the multifamily space before I pivoted to hotels, there was so much competition. This is like 2021. I remember underwriting deals with my old partners, and any deal that was a good location and it had decent marketing, there would be 40 property tours and like 30 offers.
It was insane.
And it would be multiple rounds and then we get the best and final. And the pricing guidance has wouldn't even make sense to us. And then we would like circle back to see what these things traded for a couple months later. And it'd be like millions over whatever the guidance was. And I'm like, what the hell are these people looking at? And so the competition has never been so high. And so, you know, now the rate environment's up there and rent growth has slowed down in a lot of markets. And so I think what worked in 2015, 2017, when you could buy something in 15 and sell it 18 months later, 24 months later.
Yeah, you like, guys did that, right?
We did that.
Yeah.
Yeah, we did that. And yeah, so yeah, that theoretically that worked. And you could quit your job. Like, hey, help me quit my job, right?
Right.
But you can't really bank on that in this environment. And maybe it will come back. I think, you know, things always shift and there will be another time in the market cycle to where it makes sense again. But I love that you said, you know, it's weeding out a lot of the poor operators, a lot of the operators that are kind of one foot in, one foot out. Let me test it out. Let me see if it's for me. It's weeding a lot of those folks out. We're seeing that in the short-term rental game. A lot of markets are becoming oversaturated. And, you know, you're seeing a lot of those Airbnb investors kind of pivot over. Maybe they're pivoting over to hotels, but they're finding other things. But I'm glad that you brought that up. Yes, you can make money off acquisition fees, and that's a real thing. But you never want to be in a position to where you have to rely on acquisition fees to survive. Because that means the second you stop buying, you're not gonna survive.
Oh, and totally.
It also means if you have to survive off acquisition fees and buying, then what does that tell you about the type of deals that are you forcing deals that maybe aren't the best deals? Maybe they're skinny deals and you're forcing them because of the acquisition fee. I don't know, right? But it's not a good place to be. So I think to your point, you need some sort of active income. Maybe you keep your day job. Or maybe you find another niche within the real estate investing space that kind of wraps around your primary business. Right? Because like you said,
dude. Totally agree.
Syndicating real estate, it's a long-term thing. If you give a preferred return, yeah, you get a little acquisition fee. Like we don't even take an asset management fee with our deals.
Either. Yeah.
We don't. And even if we did, it's like what, 2%? It's not going to be life-changing. So we don't do that. It's a long game. And so until we refi these deals, pull some cash out, then that's when we start making a little bit of money. But like to your point, as a GP, the investors get paid first, right? Our investors in the fund, they get paid first every single year. And then on the back end, when we exit, and a lot of this stuff that we're buying is a 10-year projected hold period. So we're not going to have our big payday as a GP until 10 years.
Yeah, I mean, that's the reality, man. So I think like when you look at it like that, right? So I'm like a math guy, right? You start stacking these chips. You say, cool, all right, we bought four. Like our goal is to buy four this year. We bought four now. Let's say they're a five-year hold. 5 years from now, we'll sell those four. Let's just say theoretically, right? You do that over and over and over and over and you start stacking. Sure, you're building this giant wealth, right? Like your net worth's growing, but you're still like, you're not eating. You're not like, so you got to have some cash flow along the way. So totally agree. It's find some other like avenue to grab some cash flow because you're exactly right. People become desperate for deals when they're living on acquisition fees. And all of a sudden they're like, yeah, it doesn't really work, but we'll make it work. Like you hear that all the time. Like new investors are like, okay, cool. The way you taught me to underwrite, this doesn't really work, but I think I can do it. I'm like, dude, no, that's not how it works. The math is sure. Underwriting is a guess. But if your underwriting says no, the answer is no. You just got to move on. You can't get caught up in that thing. So that's the challenge. If you have no other income, that could be really tough because then you're desperate for deals. We're looking at a deal last week, A-class property, downtown Tulsa. Great property, amazing property. And I talked to the broker and he's like a friend of mine. He's like, yeah, man, they're underwater. He's like, you bought this 2 years ago. Kind of that whole they just really love, they fell in love with the property, and then they just haven't made the cash flow they thought they would, so they got offloaded. They're going to lose money on this deal. And that's not that uncommon right now, because you're right, especially if you bought in 2020, dude, rates have climbed so much that you're in this pinch.
Yeah.
You know, so people are like semi-forced to sell, which I think there's some opportunity in this market. We kind of go into that as well. But like, for now, if you're listening, syndication is a get-rich-slow game.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, I actually went out to Houston 5 months ago. Parker was with me and interviewed the apartment rockstar, Robert Martinez. He just foreclosed on a, at the time he had just foreclosed.
$50 million?
Back in October. $51 million ooh, loan. Yeah. And I think it was, the deal was like a 70-something million dollar deal. $17 million of investor equity gone. And he bought right before the rates went up on floating rate debt, bought a Class A deal. There was a time where everyone was like, well, the cap rates in multifamily for C class and B class were essentially the same as A class.
Yeah.
Right? People were paying, like, we sold that 32-unit value add 1960s construction in a suburb of Indianapolis, and the buyer paid like a 3.7 cap rate.
I remember
because we renovated 50% of the units and we're like, hey, we left some meat on the bone for you, dog. And he came in and I remember doing the math on the actuals and he paid like a 3.7 cap rate. I'm like, well, you can buy an A-class building in a prime market for that same cap rate. So a lot of people were thinking, okay, well, let me just buy the A-class stuff. It's the same cap rate. Well, there's no value add. And then guess what? Rates go up. Rent growth is not going up anymore. And cap rates are starting to go up. And there's no room to add the value when you buy these types of assets. So with Robert, that deal went back.
You know, it's funny, man. I'm going to kind of nerd out here. Way back, I remember Grant Cardone came on you guys'. He was on your show here too, I think. But I remember listening to The Takeoff and he came on and you guys talked about cap rates compressing. And I think people didn't quite understand what that meant. But now we're seeing what that meant. I remember a friend reached out who's buying a deal in Austin and I'll never forget. It was like a C minus. Like it was tough. And I was like, go through the underwriting. I'm like, dude, you're buying this at like a 4.1 cap.
Yeah.
It's a C minus deal in Austin. What's happening? He's like, oh man, it's 4% cash flow. People are going to love it. And that was happening a lot. And the other thing I remember is I was at an event in Denver in like 2020, like late 2020, it's probably 21, because it was like out of COVID, right? It was like one of the first ones we went to live again. And the lender on stage was like, we have this bridge debt. You guys should all be in it, right? It's 3.25, 2 years, amazing interest only. And like those two things were being talked about a lot. It was like buy in Austin, buy in Dallas at 3% in this floating rate or this bridge debt. People found themselves in a really tough position. But like the lender, like the guy was telling people to get that debt. I'm not saying he like, no one could have predicted, right?
I did two deals with that debt.
Mm-hmm.
Freddie Floaters. And it was attractive. It was cheap.
Super attractive.
And it had a 1% prepayment penalty. And so if you were going to add a lot of value and you're going to refi or you're going to exit, what had 1% prepayment penalty. If you remember 3 years ago, what was killing a lot of deals and transactions was a lot of people had yield maintenance.
Oh yeah, that would
crush
you
some now. Of these prepayment penalties would be like over $1 million. And so it just never, it killed a lot of deals. And so people are like, oh, I get a 1% prepayment penalty and I can, you know, double the value of this property through a value add business plan. Well, we did a couple of those loans and then our debt service with the lender required reserve basically almost quadrupled overnight.
That's insane.
And
man.
So we had to stop distributions for a quarter on both of these properties, still own those properties, the Arbors Townhomes and the Timber Creek Apartments, both in Greensboro, North Carolina. But we communicated to the investors, hey, this is what's going on. The rates have gone up. Our debt service has almost quadrupled with the lender required reserve. We need to stop distributions for a little bit. But the good news was we bought those assets good at a good price. And we're able to achieve a lot of rent growth and a lot of NOI growth. And so with the Arbors, we did we refied into 5.5% fixed early 2023. And we were actually able to pull out $2 million on that deal.
Oh, sweet.
We returned $2 million back to the investor. Our equity raise for that deal was 4. So we returned exactly 50%. We got caught up on that missed distribution. And then the Timber Creek Apartments, we didn't pull money out, but we were able to we didn't have to put cash in. And we also refied in about 5.5 fix, which is assumable. And even today, that debt is attractive.
Super attractive.
You're underwriting multifamily deals. If you can assume 5.5 right now, that's with interest only, that's not too bad, right?
I would take that. Yeah. So we're like, I mean, so the other thing too, this is cool to bring this up. where are the deals right now, right? Like, I think you have to get creative. And there's a ton of assumable debt out there. We've closed three. And yeah, assuming debt sucks. Let's just call it what it is. It's a lot of work. But
assuming debt?
Yeah, assuming.
I've never assumed a loan. Why is it challenging?
I have this, like, I always ask the lender, like, why is this taking so long? Here's their answer. Is if you're assuming, so we're assuming a 4.25% right now as we speak.
Wow, that's great.
And yeah, it's awesome. But you're like, they're, the bank is like, the new loans, we're at 6.75%. We're making more money.
Yeah.
You're in the back of the pile.
Mm.
You're assuming this loan that's not making us really any money. In fact, might be losing banks a little bit of money. You're like, we don't really care about you. We're just transferring you over. That's like paperwork nonsense for them, right? So you're just kind of the back of the road. And then there's all this stuff where it's the same process. They're qualifying you, but you're just slower. And then they're like, okay, you have to meet all the original requirements. Does the debt service still cover all this stuff? So it's a little bit more like time consuming. So what I tell people is if you're assuming debt, make sure your PSA is at least 120 days, which is not an exaggeration. It's like, I would say the average is probably 6 month close period of assuming debt.
Wow.
Yeah.
So that's crazy.
Well, you know what? Here's the thing is like you go into it knowing it. Going eyes wide open, like, all right, cool. Like, hey, Mr. Seller, we're super down to buy your property. We're down to assume your debt. Here's the truth, though. It's going to take some time. Like, and if you're a seller, same story, right? People are like, sweet, we're selling this property. You need to communicate to investors. It's going to take some time. Mm-hmm. Like, we're under contract on one right now where we're selling. They're assuming our note. That was the first email I sent out. It was like, hey, congratulations. We're under contract. We're all going to make some money, but there's a debt assumption, and I can tell you it's going to be a while. And so people are excited, but you know, it comes back to what you were saying though, like what you guys said to your investors, I think this is a huge lesson for listeners too. Tell the truth, which I know that's like, yeah, of course. But I think a lot of like investor updates get sort of like fudged, not fudged, but it's not the whole truth is told. If you're like, hey, our debt service quadrupled, we're going to pause distributions. Here's why. We didn't see this coming. No one saw this coming. Tell the truth. You're going to probably earn more investors than anything else. If you're like, times get hard, times, some are good, some are bad, some deals are better than others. Congrats to you guys for getting out of that though, because there's a lot of people who are in a different position, so.
Yeah, I mean, if we didn't grow the NOI enough, we would have to bring cash in at the refi, and then now you go to investors, more money.
That'd be a tough conversation.
Pause distributions, that's a tough conversation to be had. But I agree with you. I would say, and this is just speculation, but based on the folks that I know that invest in other deals with other sponsors, I've heard that a lot of communication is pretty poor. And, you know, I've seen it. But so with Summers Capital, I'm like, dude, we communicate regularly and we over-communicate sometimes. Like closing on the Bodega deal last week.
Oh, congrats, by the way.
Thank you.
That.
I appreciate it. But there was a time where we were sending out updates every single week. What's going on? Because a lot of moving parts. And so I'm like, dude, we communicate everything, the good and the bad. And investors never hit me up. I never get calls from investors because we just over-communicate everything.
That's so true. You're almost like saving yourself time. So we send a monthly update for every property. And I'm the same way. I'm like, dude, we're going to show pictures that are good, pictures that are bad. Like we had one property, it had this flood and two of the units were bad. And I sent pictures of the flood because I was like, this happens, man. This is part of the deal. We're going to fix it. You know, we have money for that, right? But like, here's what's going on in the property. Here's the cool things. Here's the bad things. So I totally with you. Over-communicate's the way to go. And again, be honest, like, dude, here's cool things. Here's the not so cool things. Here's the things we're struggling with. Here's what we're trying to get better at. All that. And I think people dig it. And then to your point, you never hear from investors, you know?
We just renovated and did a grand opening with the hotel here in December. Late January, we had record rainfall and four of the units got flooded out. We had to shut down the hotel for a little bit. Insurance denied our claim. And so, you know, transparent with investors. This is what's going on. This is what we're going to do to, you know, recoup as much funds as we can. But, you know, in the meantime, we're funding this with our own money. We're getting the units back online so we can start, you know, open up the hotel again. And we did. And then, you know, we hired a public adjuster to try to recoup whatever funds they can from the insurance company. We applied for the disaster relief program here in California that will, you know, hopefully bring some more funds back. So, you know, communicate it. And yeah, it sucks, but I put it out there. I even put it on social media. I'm like, this is part of real estate investing that like a lot of people don't talk about, but this is part of the game. You can't plan for everything. Shitty things happen and you just got to react and move on.
I love that. So like I was just talking to my partner this morning. So he has this tenant and it's like way back, one of his first properties ever bought. This tenant is paying rent, great tenant, like all the way through, all of a sudden decides to sue him for like lack of care of the property or something. And it's so nonsense, right? But he calls me up. He's like, man, this tenant's paid and is still paying through this process. It's a great property. And it's like new. It's like 2010 or something. She's just trying to grab some money. And like that stuff doesn't get talked about. Unfortunately, some stuff in real estate's pretty challenging. But like, again, come in eyes wide open. So I appreciate you telling the truth, man. Things are hard sometimes. Like it's not all like, okay, buy a multifamily, hire the property manager, manage the manager and move on and get rich. That's not reality, right? It still takes a lot of effort and a lot of work.
If you think you're just going to hire a property manager and sit back and collect passive income, good luck.
Like, no, it takes a lot of effort.
First of all, a lot of PMs are not great. And second of all, I mean, dude, especially if you're doing a renovation, all that sort of stuff, you got to find the right property manager. And then two, you got to be on top of them. Asset management is a real thing. It's hands-on. You got to be making the decisions. You got to be on top of everything. And it's a whole relationship between the asset manager and the property manager.
Oh, yeah.
Right? You can't just expect to go in there and set all these crazy timelines and micromanage them. Like you got to build a relationship. You got to make them respect you so they do the things that you want, create some sort of alignment of interest.
It's almost like I'm an employee, right? Like not exactly, but it's kind of like this, like, all right, have some mutual respect. Like this person's going to work on your property and they care about it usually, right? Like take the time to like, to your point, not be an asshole, you know? But asset management is hard, man. Watching the budget of where we projected versus where we are and those things, like it takes a lot of effort.
Mm-hmm.
So I think a good asset manager is, super valuable. Same for a good PM. Like yeah. Property manager is super, super key.
Yeah. No, absolutely. With real estate investing, asset protection and protecting yourself from personal liability is huge. The best way to address this is to correctly set up your LLCs and entity structure. For us at Summers Capital, we use Prime Corporate Services to set up, manage, and provide guidance for all of our entities, making it truly hands-off. If you want to learn more, visit primecorporateservices.com/richsummers to book a free call and receive a special podcast listener offer. Again, visit primecorporateservices.com/richsummers to book a free call. Now back to the show. So yeah, man, I don't know. I think, with multifamily right now, I love the asset class and I still own multifamily. I want to buy more, but right now just kind of doing the hotel stuff for now, as I see this as the opportunity. And like all market cycles, like all asset classes, things shift. And I believe in 2 or 3 years, I think boutique hotels will be oversaturated. I think there's going to be a time where all these Airbnb investors kind of figure it out. And then there's going to be all these people chasing the boutique hotels. And that's where I'll probably pivot back to multifamily, if it's the right asset class and the right opportune time. So I don't know, we'll see. But for now, I'm like, we're going this direction. But I love multifamily because I'm like, it's evergreen. There's never going to be a replacement for two things, a place for people to sleep and a place for people to store their belongings. That's never going to go anywhere. So I think from a risk-adjusted return basis, multifamily is the safest asset class out there. You could argue that it might be the most recession resilient as long as you're buying right.
Yeah, so
that's
funny.
The key component.
Well, a couple of things I want to say to that. First of all, I heard you on a podcast. I don't know if it's this one or a different one, but I heard you say like you don't really love the 5-year goal thing. Like you prefer like let's focus on this year.
Yeah,
because you got to pivot sometimes, right? Like yeah. Even though I'm full in on multifamily, like I think that's my lane. I try and avoid shiny object. I think there is a time and a place where like, all right, multifamily is super hard. I live in San Diego. I got all the skills and knowledge to like pivot to this hotel space or whatever you're going to do and keep it short term where like you might say, cool, now 2 years from now, I might swing back to that. Right.
Yeah.
Or whatever. But I just love that. And the other thing too, is like, I would say I had a guest, his name's Jacob on my podcast out of Denver. They own like 6,000 self-storage units. And I was asking him about it. Similar stories, like one of the best guests ever. Cause he was like, dude, self-storage is really, really hard. Like really hard. It's harder than multifamily. And I was like, oh man. Cause I have this like, it seems like it's easier. Like evictions are easier. People never move, all that stuff. He's like, yeah, but it's just way, way different. Like he said, people come to a self-storage facility and they're there. They're usually like bumming. They're like, ah, oh, this sucks to be here. I'm storing my crap and I'm paying these guys. He's like, people don't feel that way about multifamily, especially hotels. So this is awesome. Like if you think about the mentality of owning those things and running those things, he's like, it's actually way easier to run those things. Cool thing about a hotel space is even more fun. Like people who are coming to a boutique hotel are like super excited. So if you're staff, I mean, it's hard. It's hospitality. They're usually in a great mood, right? So there's like, there is some mentality behind some of this stuff too.
Mm-hmm.
That we don't.
There's more variables.
Yeah, for sure.
Self-storage, there's not a lot of like levers and variables, and their expense ratios are very low. I don't know too much about it, but I know a lot of money can be made in self-storage, and same with these other asset classes. I mean, I think even in office space, there's opportunities right now, even though it's struggling, but with struggling asset classes comes discounts and comes opportunities.
No
doubt. And, you know, I think the one thing I love about real estate investing, dude, is there's 250 ways that you can make money.
No doubt. You know? And it's like, it's so funny. Like there, you say that, but that's not an exaggeration. Like,
it's
like sometimes I hear new stuff. I'm like, I didn't know you could do that. I didn't know you could make money. Of course, there's like debt and all those things too.
Yeah.
But there's a million ways to make money in real estate. So yes. Yeah. Great, great way to build some wealth, man.
Yeah. And I think to that point though, because there's 250 ways to make money in real estate, I think that stops a lot of people because they're like, there's too many decisions to be made and they don't know which path to go down.
Yeah. I mean, it's like anything, right? It's like analysis paralysis, which I kind of hate that phrase, but it's super true. It's like, oh, I can make money doing this. Oh, maybe I'll try that. When that gets hard, I'll try this other thing. Like, I think sometimes it's like the consistency. It's like anything. I mean, like, I think health is the easiest analogy. Like, go to the gym, right?
Yeah.
You go to the gym once, you hear people talk about this, no change. Go to the gym twice, no change. Go to the gym 10 times, maybe see, you're going to be sore, right? Go to the gym 100 times, then you're starting to see some gains, right? It's similar with real estate. All right, pick your lane. Find someone who's done it before you, by the way. Like, find a freaking mentor. If you're listening to this, it's a little bit self-serving because I coach people. Find someone who's done what you've done and pay them. Or offer some serious value, not just like, hey, can I shadow you? Like, that's super annoying. For someone like you, if someone asks that, you're like, nah, no thanks, man. It's actually a pain. You know, but if they're like, dude, I'll come to your hotel and I will paint 5 rooms for you if I can just like listen to what you're saying while you're in there, something like that. Even better, if you got the money, pay someone to do it. Pay someone who's doing what you're doing and then put in the freaking reps. Do the time. It's like the gym. Do it 100 times. Underwrite 100 deals, dude. It's just the way it is.
I agree with you there. I think you're either going to pay with your time or your money. But either way, you're gonna pay with some money.
Yeah, because you're gonna make mistakes.
You're gonna make
right?
mistakes, and that costs money.
Yeah.
But if you really want to shortcut your path from point A to point B, I think paying for mentorship, getting around the folks, and this works for anything, not just apartments, not just boutique hotels, like literally anything within business or real estate, or even becoming an athlete. Find someone that's done it, and you know it's done it at a high level. Pay them, and you're gonna shortcut your path from point A to point B. It's the path of least resistance, if you would.
Man, it's like your mastermind, right?
Yeah.
Like people cruise in, if they want to know boutique hotels, get in Rich's mastermind. Just like join it. It's worth whatever. I don't even know what you're charging. I'm pitching it because that is a mastermind. Super, super valuable. Be in a room of people who are doing it with you. And you're like, hey man, are you struggling with underwriting? Yeah, me too. Hey, you struggling to raise capital? Yeah, me too. You know, just it's this sense of like belonging. And then you've got someone like you who can like kind of lead the ship of like, hey, I've done this before. Here's the challenges I've faced. And to your point, you're either going to pay for it up front or you're going to pay for it in mistakes.
Yeah.
And it's a whole lot easier to pay up front and like get some expert advice. So,
totally. Yeah. I agree, man. So you mentioned that you're partnering on a deal with Eric Chatterton.
Yeah. Yeah.
Eric's great. He was recently on the podcast. What are you guys buying?
Yeah. So I'm like dancing on the edge here a little bit. We're closing next week. So I feel like I can talk about it. It's 506B. So I won't tell the whole details, but it's a deal in Texas, 80-ish units. $6.5 million purchase. This is the assumable one.
Got
it. So we're assuming a debt of 4.25. Pretty sweet. And I can talk about it because it's closing so quick that we won't, you know, be bumping into some rules here. But
no.
Great property, dude. It's and the cool thing is like we have one other deal there that Eric wasn't part of, but our partner there lives there. He's got 1,000 units in that city. They're vertically integrated. They'd only bought with their own money, like private, like investors. And then we met them at an event. My partner met him at an event and he's like, what's the syndication thing? And we're like, that's what we do. If you can do what you do and run the ship, we'll bring investors and like do the syndication piece of it and do all the investor communication. So it's a perfect partnership. So we have great partners there.
Gotcha. And so are you primarily co-GP in deals right now?
Yeah. I mean, the deals that we own that we're like the lead GP, you know, just like anyone would say this, it's your favorite deal. Like you found the deal, you sourced the debt. Most of the investors are yours. Those are the ones, right? we are co-GPs on deals where people are like, hey, you know, they see that we invest or communicate well. So like people will bring us in for like asset management communication a lot and raising capital, of course, right? But so we're on 11 deals right now. I think six of them were like the lead GP. The other five were just, yeah, we're like kind of helping people out. The challenge is you're not the lead GP. So you didn't really necessarily find the deal, negotiate the deal. You got to underwrite it to join them. Like I'm always like, yeah, be on board with this thing, right? But you're not the lead asset manager. So it's not my favorite, but I don't mind it either. Like if you trust those partners, sometimes that's a cool way to build it.
What are you guys doing? I'm curious. What are you guys doing in today's climate? You know, just given where we are with interest rate environment and the economy, what are you guys doing differently today in regards to underwriting and some of these assumptions to like rent growth and exit cap rate and even like, you know, the interest rate environment, right? If you're underwriting to some sort of refi in year three, you know, what does that look like? I'm curious, how do these assumptions differ from where we were 3 years ago?
Man, I'll try not to be boring because again, I'm a numbers guy, right? So I don't want to get too far in the weeds here, but I'll say exit cap always, always, always going to look worse than when you buy it, right? Like we do 10 basis points per year, assuming it's going to be worse. So if you're buying it at a six cap, you're selling 5 years from now, we're going to assume the cap rate's 6.5. And for those listening, if you don't know what that means, it just means we assume the market's worse. It means you're going to sell it at a cost basis slightly lower than you would now, which is just good underwriting, in my opinion. As far as refis, I don't underwrite for refis, ever. Like we always are going to get the amount of debt for the length of term or 2 years longer than the hold period. Because if rates go up, which who knows, right? It's probably unlikely at this point. I still don't want to be caught in that trap. So we are never underwriting for a refi, but we're just going to say we're exiting 5-7 years and our debt's going to be at least that long. People just got caught in that trap and I don't want to do that. So here's the cool thing is if it goes the other way, which is more likely right now, debt falls and we're like, sweet, we can refi in 3 years, but we didn't underwrite for that. Just a huge bonus.
Yeah.
So underwriting, I'll say, looks very similar. Like I don't think it's you know, the assumptions have changed. But we got to get more creative. So here's like one example would be we're buying deals with bank debt where the bank will fund up to 80% and then we're doing a line of credit. So there's a certain banks out there like in Oklahoma and Arkansas, they'll do 80% LTV.
80%? Mm-hmm. Wow. These are like local banks and credit unions?
Yeah.
On up to what kind of loan balances are we talking?
So I'll give you an example. Like close a deal that was 62 units in Little Rock.
Okay.
And maybe 68 units, either way. And it was like a $5 million purchase. I think it was 5.1. We funded up to 80% of that. So the loan balance was just over 4 million. Then they gave us a $600,000 line of credit to do the repairs. So the cool thing is we're raising capital for the down payment and then like some fees and stuff, right? So we probably raised 1.6, something like that. But then we got this line of credit that we're not paying on until we use. So like we would do a bunch of repairs. We take out $100,000. You got to do a draw, but you're not paying on the other five, right? So you have it sitting there, but you're not paying for it. So that's a really cool trick that we've done where it's like, now you've got this sort of mixed rate where you're paying on the first loan. So the 4.1 is at 7.25, I think. So that's just going to be what it is. But then the line of credit, we're not paying on until we use it. So we still got like $400,000, probably like 380 of that line of credit sitting ready to be used. And then I got a little scared because I was like, what if they just like cancel that? Because that's happened before.
Right.
So we
were
like,
using the line, they can always adjust it.
Totally. So we were like, talk to the bank. We're like, hey, in this agreement, we're going to say you can't pull this line ever, as long as we own the property. And so the bank president guy was like, this is super unusual, but I'm in. I trust you guys. So we've done that twice where we have a bank debt that's really high leverage because like Freddie Fannie, dude, they're only like 65% right now. So local bank will do up to 80 plus line of credit. That's pretty cool. And then the other thing we've done is this is kind of unusual, but we'll do like a seller carry for a small amount. So I think people hear like seller carry, they think that the seller's got to carry the whole thing. It's like, well, no. What if the seller wants to carry $200,000 or $300,000? It's kind of like
in just like a bonus. Second position.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's always got to be second position. I mean, the bank or Freddie's not really going to allow it ever, but like a local bank's always going to be first.
They're cool with it. But yeah. So the local banks are cool with the second position as long as it's not too over leveraged.
Yeah, they don't want to. Yeah, exactly. But even in that case, they'll usually let you go to 90%. So
really?
Let's say, wow. Yeah. So if you, let's say you bought a property for $5 million, the bank will loan up to four, just an example. you could borrow another 500 from the seller so long as you had a path to like improve your property, right?
Yeah.
Well, they just want to see you improve the property.
Yeah.
They want to see that your debt service can cover. So it's all a cash flow game too. Like you got to have, you know, your debt covered, but they usually don't care about the second. Like local banks are like, we're in first position.
They're getting their money either way.
Yeah.
So they don't really care. Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree. Yeah. In the hotel space, second positions are very common. Just seller financing in general in the hotel space is very common. So a lot of lenders in the hotel space are totally cool with it. If the seller carries in second. But you mentioned Freddie and Fannie. They're capped at about 65%. Is that every market, every multifamily deal right now?
That's what we're seeing.
Really?
Yeah.
I've been out of the multifamily game for a little bit. So, okay. So tell me more on that. That's just because of the volatility in the marketplace and they're just kind of hedging 100%. Their risk right now?
Yeah. So even like last year, so like early 23, they were like 60. Like you were seeing like 62% where they were like maxing out. So no deals were working with Freddie. So it was basically like an assumption game or a local bank game, in my opinion. And even now they're like, you know, a lot of rate quotes you'll see, they're like, oh, we can go to 70. And then as you go through the deal, they're like, actually more like 64. You know, stuff like that happens a lot. So I'm planning on around 65 with Freddie Fannie, even in a good deal.
Got it. And the local banks, credit unions, they're going up to 80.
Yeah, the rates can be higher. So like Freddie Fannie is going to be the best rate by far, 6.25 right now. But local banks can be 7.25, but the leverage is way higher. So it's all a math game, right? Like Pace talked about this on your show. He's like, would you pay $1 million for a property? No, but what if you only had to pay $1 a month for 9 months? Like that's an extreme example, but it's kind of that thing is like, all right, we're going to pay a higher rate, but we got more leverage. And if we got a line of credit above that, we don't have to raise as much. Investor money is the most expensive money, which also doesn't get talked about, right?
Yeah, it is. Like, I mean, if you're doing, I mean, we always underwrite to investor returns, right? So, you know, and what investors want traditionally 15 to 20% average annualized return. Well, that's what's your cost of capital? 15 to 20%. And the deal does well and you end up paying them 23, 24%. That's your cost of capital.
Yeah, which is great for them. But
with the rate environment, I mean, even if you're paying 10 or 12% on a freaking bridge loan, that's still half the cost, you know?
Yeah. It's interesting. Like people I don't think about that, right? So like private money right now is like 12%. Just did a small deal with private money. Closed the deal. It was awesome. Like there was no fees, nothing. It was just 12%. And people were like, what? 12%? That's insane. I'm like, that's a whole lot cheaper than an investor who wants 20%, right? So if we can do it with private capital, yeah, 12% is what it is. But if the cash flow is a cash flow, it's all a math game.
Yeah. No, that's true, man. That's true. As a busy real estate investor or entrepreneur, time is money and first impression is everything. Every day to make it easy on myself, I wear Built Basics clothing. Whether you're a girl or guy looking for workout gear, joggers, shirts, button-downs, hats, or shoes, Built's got you covered. Super comfortable, tight in all the right places to make you look fresh and clean all the time. Visit BuiltBasics.com and use promo code SUMMERS20 to receive 20% off of your order. Again, that's BuiltBasics.com. That's BYLTBasics.com. Use promo code SUMMERS20 to receive 20% off of your order. Now back to the show. I was talking to someone out in Orlando recently, and I was out there for a speaking engagement, and he has a private debt fund, and he solely targets IRAs, 401ks. He just has 10% compounding return. Money's tied up for 4 years. After 4 years, it's liquid. You can pull it as much as you want. And he just raises from like $200,000 to $300,000 individual investors who have 401ks, IRAs from old employers that they want to roll over. And he's like a $75 million fund. I was doing a lot of research on it today. There's like $38 trillion in retirement accounts in America today. And
that's
so
a lot of money.
Yeah. And the average annualized return of 401ks over the last 5 years is actually 4.7.
Oh my gosh.
And so if you can show someone 10% compounding and what that does over a 15, 20 year time horizon, that's a lot of money. And then you can take that money and go fund your own deals. And now instead of paying 15, 20% to investor, you're just paying 10%.
Yeah, I know a guy who does this too out of Dallas. And a lot of GoBundance guys invest with them actually. And which is a mastermind, if you're listening, it's a great mastermind. But people will invest and it's like semi-liquid. So he says it takes about a month to get your capital back. So if you want, you can pull it out. That's like his pitch.
But these are retirement accounts. Most people probably let
don't
it roll, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Especially self-directed.
Where else are you
going to
get that?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's like 9, 10%, something like that. I don't think it's compounding. I'm not sure exactly how his works, but like yeah, it's a guaranteed 10%. And then like, that's what he's doing. He's taking that money. He's going to do his own deals and he's making significantly more, because here's the thing about a syndication or like raising in capital for investors is we only own 20 or 30% of the deal as a GP, right? The investors on the whole other portion of it. So if you've got this fund that you can pull and technically you're the only owner, like your group's the only owner, you're going to do way better than 10%, right? So it's really, really smart for sure.
Yeah. So I don't know, man. I'm like looking into this stuff. I'm like, well, maybe that's a potential fund in the future until we just solely target IRAs, 401ks, all the retirement money out there. I think with, you know, all the baby boomers retiring and all that, I think there's a big play there. So we'll see. But I thought that was unique and interesting. And I was actually talking to Ryan Pineda last week, and he's doing the same thing right now. He's raising under Pineda Capital for something very similar to where they're targeting IRAs and 401ks. And so I think this is going to be a big thing that I haven't heard a lot of people talk about.
It's funny, like even in the last couple of years, and maybe it's just because I'm in the space, but you do hear more and more and more like people closing on retirement and they're like interested in these other assets. So I would say even like 4 years ago, real estate was like considered like an alternative asset, right? Or asset class, especially compared to the market. But now I think people are like, oh, I can roll some of my retirement funds into this other thing. That's pretty crazy. You know, like people I never thought would invest are like, oh yeah, well now I would like to move some money over to real estate. So it's getting pretty exciting.
It's like, hey, you can actually be a partner on some of these large commercial buildings using your retirement account. Did you know that? Most of them had no idea, no clue. How does that work? Oh, it's actually pretty simple. You know?
Yeah.
I would say 30% of our investors in our fund, our hotel fund, are invested through their self-directed IRAs.
You know, it's funny. Like we have a friend that does self-directed IRAs, and I send her an email, I would say at least twice a week, of an introduction. Be like, hey, can you set this person up with a self-directed IRA? Because it's so, so, so powerful, man. Yeah. Like we're getting more and more people be like, how do I get retirement funds in here? So it's nice to just have somebody where I'm like, can you help them get their retirement funds over? And then like, let's get in our deal. If our deal doesn't work, here's the other thing I'm gonna say, real estate is like, there's so much to go around, man. Like that's why I love stuff like this. Like you are sharing all of your tips. Like you're sharing all of your pathway. Why? Because there's so much money to be made and there's competition, sure, but it's such a freaking cool environment to be in, man. So like real estate is just people help each other. It's amazing.
I agree. I mean, the larger the deal, and that's why I like commercial real estate, because the larger the deal, the bigger the team. And like you said, there's so much money out there in the world. I mean, we just talked about a $38-something trillion in retirement accounts alone. So think about that. So I think there's enough money out there to where everyone can win. What we do, if we have like a investor that's wants to move forward with their 401k IRA, assuming it's with like an old employer, is we'll just set them up on an intro call with Alex and my team and a custodian that we work with. We work with Newview Trust and Horizon. They're both pretty good and they like vetted our fund. And so we just do a little intro call, 15 minutes, the investor, the custodian, Alex, kind of get on the same page. Hey, this is the process. It's going to take 3 to 6 weeks, depending on how quick you move with the paperwork. If you move quickly, it can be done in 3 weeks and boom, you just stay on top of it. And then eventually the money comes in. It's, you know, on our end, it's the same as cash. The reporting is a little bit different. But other than that, I'm like, these folks are stoked because it's like, you know, they didn't even know it was a possibility. And now they're getting higher returns than they were before.
Oh, yeah. I think the one thing to know is like there's a handful of rules, right? Like I don't want to be like the rule guy on this, but you can't typically invest in like the one thing that gets me is like my uncle or my dad or something. Like you're not really supposed to invest in your
own deal.
Like, yeah, your own deal or like your son's deal or whatever. There's actually ways around that too. Like if your lawyer will write a letter.
You can't invest in your family member's deal?
Yeah.
Really?
You're not supposed to. But there's a lot of like gray area there. So like if a lawyer writes a letter, like if your lawyer on your deal writes a letter saying, I approve this, it can be done. Like that's what we just had. I'm like, I don't understand this, but I'm down. So I think there's a handful of rules. The other thing is like depreciation is a little different, but but here's the thing. It's like it's stuck in a retirement account, right? So to your point, you just said 4% is what the...
Yeah, it was like 4%. I was just looking into it this morning. The average annualized return for all 401ks under Fidelity over the last 5 years was about 4.6%. Average fees was almost a point. It was like 0.86.
Which I think people forget there's points, right? So like if you can't beat 4.5%, let's just call it even 5% a good scenario. If you can't beat that in your fund, like something's gone wrong, like probably out of your control even, but like, that's why it's so cool. Cool. I can get 15% in Rich's fund. That's a whole lot better than 5, man. So yeah, I really enjoy like finding the routes to help people get wealthier for no, like none of their own work. That's like the coolest part about all, what we're doing, right?
You mentioned you guys do a, you're doing a 506B right now. Do you mess with the C's at all or just solely 506B?
We don't like the deals we run, but there is now a new rule where you can close the B and open a C on the same deal. And so we're talking about doing that on a couple deals because it'd be kind of cool to advertise, right?
We did that with our fund. We started the fund as a B. We bought a couple assets as a B and then we switched it over to a C.
How'd it go?
Good, because you kind of, you fill up your 35 non-accredited right. And that's then it's like, you might as well switch it up.
So they went like, was it successful?
Yeah, because we, I think it's perfect hybrid because then you can allow non-accrediteds come in, you know, friends and family. And then we fill up the 35 non-accredited and then, or you get close to it and then you switch it over to a C and then you can market, solicit and advertise. And, you know, a lot of our accredited investors and a lot of our investors that have a lot of firepower that are writing the bigger checks, they're all accredited in anyways. So it's a win-win, you know, you can get both folks in and I really like it. And it's so quick and easy to switch.
Yeah. How much did it cost you? Can I ask you? Do you know? Because that's what we were talking about. I'm like, how much the cost? I'm like, I don't know, probably $5,000 of lawyer fee.
Yeah, but it wasn't much to switch. I think it was everything switching and some other stuff all baked in was less than $10,000.
I put you on the spot, man. Sorry.
No, you're good. The set up the fund was a lot more. Setting up funds is a good amount more than the single asset stuff. But also, we started using Bethany LaFlamme probably like 6 months ago as our SEC attorney. And she's great. She works with a lot of bigger operators and she's her pricing is very competitive. Prior to this, we were using another group and they're great, but dude, not cheap at all.
Yeah.
Expensive.
It's funny. Like there's a huge discrepancy. I'll just call it out. A lawyer charges $12,000 for a syndication.
$12,000?
Yeah.
That's great.
Yes. Like he's a great guy. He's like a friend of mine, but
Bethany charges $20,000 for a single asset, $30,000 for a fund.
And I think the going rate's like $25,000 for a single asset, something like that, right? So she's still on the cheap side. But it's also like we help them with the work. Like we kind of fill out like some of this stuff is sort of templated, right? So we'll kind of do that stuff for him. He likes it, but it's expensive. I mean, it's just a reality, right? Like it costs money. And so it's funny, when you look at the capital stack and you go into like underwriting, it's like, okay, you're buying a $5 million asset, the debt's at 4. The first thing you think is like, okay, I need to raise $1 million for the down payment. It's like, well, no, there's a lot of fees and a lot of other stuff you got to raise for, right? So that's just the reality of real estate. So in underwriting, you got to make sure you got all that stuff baked in.
Yeah, no, absolutely. A lot of stuff that goes into it. Due diligence costs, legal fees. But yeah, I mean, the SEC stuff, man, that stuff can add up. You work on, I would say, find an SEC attorney that has a flat rate.
Oh yeah, that's what I was saying. Like, this is it. Cause some stuff comes up, right?
Yeah.
So, well, hey, Rich, I was going to tell you about this story, man. I wanted to, we talked about this in the
sixplex.
Yeah.
Tell me about this. Okay. What the hell happened, man?
Okay. So I just wanted to tell, because if people are listening, like it's easy to connect.
This is your deal?
This. Yeah. Okay. So this is how I got started. This is the story I wanted to tell.
First deal?
Like, first like multifamily deal.
Okay.
The sixplex is, it's funny. Like now you look back at a sixplex and it's six units, you know, it's kind of a pain. But when you're starting, it's a huge thing, right? So if people are listening, I want to like tell the story. It's like, it's just kind of a cool one. So early on, my wife and I, we bought a single family. Like we were just starting out, right? Like I heard about real estate, whatever. So our son was just born. So I would just walk the streets and just like every for rent sign I saw and every for sale sign I saw, I would call. And I'd be like, hey, I know you're renting this. Looks like a great place. Would you sell it? That's basically how I got my reps of like learning the business. And I've heard you talk about like, in the car game and stuff, right? Yeah. Like you just, it's sales.
Yep.
Like you're learning to hear the word no and be okay with it. So finally I walk up on this guy. This is like after a year of doing this, we owned two single families at this time and we didn't have any money, like just a reality. So I come up to this guy and he's sitting in front of this multiplex and he's literally putting the sign in the ground, like for rent. And it's faded, like this old sign, hadn't changed in 10 years. And I was like, hey, how's it going? My name's Eric. And so you're putting a for rent sign up. Can you tell me about your property? And he's like, yeah, it's for rent. Blah, starts telling me about the unit. I'm like, okay, cool. Well, I'm actually looking to buy. Would you consider selling? And he was like, wow, I never thought about selling this thing. He's like, I'm pretty tired of it. Pretty tired of being a landlord. And he was like mid 60s. And I was like, immediately, like, this is perfect. You know, I don't want to prey on this guy. I'm like, I live down the road. So I'm, but anyway, so I'm like, cool. Let's hear about it. What would you want to sell for? And he goes, he just spits it out. He goes, but I need like $1 million for it. And in my market, it's like San Diego, like $1 million for a sixplex. It's a really good deal. So I was like, all right, you want $1 million? I'm like, okay. Do you know what seller financing is? He's like, no, what's that? I was like, well, do you mind if I get a little personal here? And I was like, do you owe any money on it? He's like, no, I inherited it. He's like, and I was like, okay, well, what roughly are you making in rents? He told me it's like $4,000 or something. Super under rented, right? And then the icing on the cake, because we start walking around, there's an empty unit that he had stored all of his mom's stuff in. So I was like, all right, can I go talk to my wife and give you a shout? Think about it a little bit and I'll call you in a couple of days. And so I call him back. I'm like, okay, I'll pay you $1 million if you would consider this owner financing thing. He's like, okay. I was like, I can put $30,000 down. Can you carry the rest? He's like, sure. Sounds great. But here's why. It's because I told him, I'm like, dude, your payment's going to be more than you're making in the rents now. And he was like, what? I'm like, yeah, your payment will go up and you don't have to do anything. And if I default, if I don't make my payments, you get your property back and it's probably in better condition than when you sold it to me, because I want to put some money into it. And so he's like, sweet, let's do it. Sign me up. I was like, all right, so we're going to be 3.5% rate, 40-year amortization, and $30,000 down, 3% down on $1 million purchase. And he's like, sweet, let's do it. Sign the papers.
Wow, just like that, that easy.
Yeah, and I was like, so then what's funny is like, I got a call from his lawyer. Small town, so I knew the guy. He's like, what are you doing? What are you doing to my client? I was like, what are you talking about? He's like, you're going to leverage 97%? I'm like, yeah, man, it's a dangerous situation, but we both know it's worth more than $1 million, right? And he doesn't care. He doesn't care what it's worth. He just wants the cash flow and he don't want to have to deal with it. Like a super, super win-win. So the reason I like to tell this story is like, if you're listening, this stuff happens and it's not all that uncommon. There's a lot of people who own real estate who don't even want it, who are sick of it or whatever, and owe either a small amount or zero. And as long as you're like being genuine, there's a win-win out there. So I like that story a lot, but it's a real steal, man. It's like happened to me.
That's so good.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing I thought about when you're telling me the story is I think sometimes the opportunity is not always with these larger commercial deals where you have a lot of institutional competition. You have more sophisticated buyers that you're competing with. Sometimes the opportunity is with these smaller deals, fourplexes or what you mentioned. You know, that's why we target some of these smaller boutique hotels from the mom and pops, because they might be mismarketed, mismanaged. And so there's opportunity to come in there and get some creative financing done. Whereas these larger deals, you know, you get all the competition out there, you get all these buyers that are savvy, sophisticated. So it's, you're a lot less likely to find those types of like good creative deals in the larger space.
Totally agree. Because you know? Usually the people who own a 50 unit or higher are just going to be more sophisticated. It's just a reality. So they're like, probably they're going to have debt on it. And they're probably going to be like, yeah, I'll carry some, but it's going to be at 8%, you know, or something, right? Like a little bit more aligned with the market. Whereas if someone like this guy, he was like, yeah, that's perfect. I get the same cash flow. And then I kind of walked him through other stuff too. Like as we got closer to the closing table, I was like, by the way, if you would have sold this for $1 million and got a check for $1 million, come April 15th, you'd be paying 150, 200 of that to the IRS. In this case, it's not like you're not paying taxes, but it's going to trickle in, right? It's going to be way more achievable in the April 15th timeline. So it's usually like a win-win-win, man. I agree. But to your point, like some of those smaller deals, like boutique hotels, perfect, right? If it's like this mom and pop who've owned it on the beach for 30 years and that was like their thing, that's an opportunity for you to come in and say, all right, we're going to take this over, freshen it up. Maybe there's an opportunity for some seller financing or something, right?
Yeah. No, absolutely. And it's really those older sellers that make good candidates for the seller financing stuff. So the first boutique hotel that we bought was up in Northern California, 10 units, beachfront. It's called the Black Sands Inn. And that seller had owned the property for 18 years. They never exceeded $180,000 in gross revenue. And they were mom and pop. They never like owned any real estate before. They never like ran a business. And, you know, there was a lot of areas to where they could have operated a lot better, but they financed a deal and we increased the value so much. Like I remember showing him the appraisal We bought it for 1.5, it appraised for 4.5. And I was like, hey.
What?
Yeah.
That's insane.
Yeah, 12 months later. And then I showed him like what we did to the revenue and all that. And he like was, couldn't even, he was in shock because they owned it for 18 years. They never even fathomed. Like he was talking when I remember buying the property from him during, when it was under contract. I remember him saying like, he thought $20,000 a month was a lot. He's like, July, August, busy months, we're doing 20K. And I'm like, dude, we're doing 80K in those busy months, which is crazy. And so he's
good
like, just
you,
in shock.
It's amazing.
Right? But all I have to say is when I showed him the new value and I'm like, hey, like I might refi you guys out. They were like, they're living on this income. They're retired and like, they need this income. So he was like, no, like I want to stay in this. But I told him, I said, look, if we ever refi you out, we did do a refi, but we had a second come in behind them. And I said, look, if we refi you out, I'll have another opportunity for you to where I can give you even more than what you're getting right now.
This is so funny, man. It's the exact same thing. Yes, it's perfect.
And so now, now whenever we refi them out, that seller is going to become an investor of ours.
Of course, because they're even going to do better probably than the rate you're giving them.
Yes. And we built that trust.
Yeah, yeah.
We did something to their property that they were not able to do over 18 years.
Yeah.
And we paid them debt service on time every single month. And so now there's that level of trust. And it's like, hey, you saw what we did with your property. Why don't you roll that into more deals with us? So
that's so smart, Rich. Good
but
job, it's, man.
But that's the power of the seller finance and also targeting these older sellers. And same thing with this guy. If you sell this property, he'll likely want to keep that rolling with you.
Oh, no, dude. So
you
I
see what I'm saying?
The story continues.
Okay.
So actually,
oh, there's more to it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I was done, but I'll keep going.
Yeah, let's hear more.
Cool.
So, let's hear more.
So I host a meetup in my town as well. And
really?
This
what's
guy
it,
comes
what's
up
it
to
called?
Me. I don't even have a name. I just call it like real estate meetup because it's a small town.
Okay.
Like,
I gotta come out and check it out sometime.
Yeah, hell yeah. Durango's fun, man. You come out, we'll show you some outside stuff.
Summertime.
We'll go on the boat.
Summertime?
Summertime's
okay,
the best.
Okay.
Yeah. So this like, and I don't really actually, during my meetup, I don't really talk about what we do very much. It's more like to give back. So people want to get into real estate. I'm like, all right, how can I help anyone who comes? Not even me. It's like who else in the room can help, but it's like a connector thing. So this guy was like, hey man, I'm looking to buy a small multifamily in Durango. Do you know anyone who has anything? This is about a year after I bought this property. And I was actually looking, this is right when I was like starting to like really ramp up Wild Oak Capital, what we do now. I needed some cash actually. So I was like, you know what? I'd sell mine. I'd sell my sixplex to you. But speaking of loyalty, I was like, I got to call the lender because this guy hooked me up and see what he thinks, right? So I call him. I'm like, hey, I'm looking to sell the property for a little bit of profit. One, would you mind? Because the bank's going to write like pay you off. Or two, would you continue that note for the next buyer? He's like, well, do you trust this guy? I'm like, yeah, I know him. He's local too, like good guy. He's like, yeah, I just want to carry the note for him too. So the new buyer comes in. I sold it for 1.15. So 150 grand more than I paid for a year earlier. And
a year later?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's what I meant, a year later. And so it's a huge payday for us, right? Like at that point, that was a monster amount of money. Really was the seed money to put into like investing in our deals and that kind of thing. But he bought it with, I hadn't paid the note down very much because it's only been a year. So like the original note was 970, it was like 965. He's buying a sixplex with this owner finance 40-year AM, 3.5% rate. The original seller's pumped because he's like, sweet, I get to carry this on. Now those guys are friends. I know all those guys. And it was just like a win-win-win.
That's crazy.
Freaking awesome.
That's
yeah,
crazy.
So similar thing. Like the first call I made was to the guy holding the note. Like I owe it to him to at least say, you know. So if he ever does sell, he'll probably become an investor too.
Totally. That's a good story, man. So yeah. I'm curious, what is your search criteria for buying deals right now?
It's funny. Our main criteria is a property manager. Their zone, there's two managers we love. He's like, well, I'll say three. He's like our zone. So we've really kind of nailed down, it's Tulsa, Arkansas area, and then this one region in Texas. And so it's really more location based than as much like a unit count based. So we can get anything from like 30 to 200 units in those markets because our managers are really solid. So it's pretty wide swath. We do want to see some value add. I'm not like an A class person. I'm definitely not a D class guy. So it's like B class, C class, 30 to 200 units.
Yeah, I like it. And you're just underwriting to like investor return?
Always. Yeah, that's the name of the game. Can you provide a solid return for people investing in your deal?
Yeah, I love that. Cool, dude. Well, listen, man, appreciate you coming down and hanging out. And I got to get myself out to Durango.
Yeah, you do.
And come check out one of your meetups sometime. So maybe this summer I'll make a little visit.
Sounds good. Thanks, Rich.
Where can listeners get in touch with you?
WildOakCapital.com. It's kind of everything. You can email me at Eric@WildOakCapital.com. I love email. Just shoot me. I promise I'll write back.
There it is. He's Eric Nelson. I'm Rich Summers. Listeners, thanks for tuning in. We'll see you in the next one. Peace.